National Gallery Podcast.
This is the National Gallery Podcast, and I'm Miranda Hinckley. We start this month with Making Colour. This new exhibition takes visitors on a voyage of discovery into the fascinating history and science behind the pigments artists have used to make dazzling works of art, from the Renaissance to Impressionism. Among the many different sources for pigments are minerals, including those that provided the most important and elusive of colours, a rich dark blue. Ahead of the exhibition opening, co-curator Caroline Campbell took Lea Caribbean behind the scenes to look at two sources for blue pigments and to find out why the National Gallery's scientific department is a great place to start thinking about this groundbreaking show.
Well, we're here because our summer exhibition, Making Colour, is really about the work of the scientific department. The exhibition is the brainchild of Ashok Roy, who for many years was head of the laboratory here. And the exhibition is intended to showcase the wonderful research which this department does into identifying pigments, the materials by which artists make paint in our collection.
On the bench here before us, we've got a lump of azurite, which is a wonderful stone with blue crystalline structure. And then next to it, an extremely expensive item. Can you tell us about it?
Well, lapis lazuli, which we call in its pigment form ultramarine, is this extraordinary semi-precious stone, comes from Afghanistan, from one particular mineral source in Badakhshan, and that produces the most extraordinarily vibrant blue. But it's also because of the distance and of the complication in extracting the pigment from the stone lapis lazuli, it's a very expensive pigment for artists to use.
Now, in the exhibition, people can see how these pigments actually ended up on the canvas or on a panel. And the exhibition includes this wonderful panel by Ugolino Denerio, The Portrayal of Christ, which has both azurite in it and ultramarine. Is that right?
The painting represents the betrayal of Christ, the moment when Judas comes and kisses Christ and he's taken by the soldiers off to his crucifixion. And Christ, who's at the centre of the painting, is wearing a robe which is ultramarine. But the figure of St. Peter, who's the other very important figure in this painting, because it's Peter who really promotes Christianity and gets Christianity going after Christ's death, the artist had the challenge of trying to show a separation between Peter and Christ. And Peter, who's wearing his great beard, which is usually how one identifies him, and looking very venerable, his robe, which is all blue, is azurite, and it looks very greenish in tinge, and it's very different. Now, colour is sometimes used as a visual tool to enable us how to look and how to see. And so the robe of Christ is using ultramarine, and the robe of Peter is using this different blue, also important, but subtly different and possibly also subtly inferior.
But of course, this exhibition isn't just about blue, is it?
No, this exhibition is about much more than blue. We'll go through all the colours of the spectrum. We'll also look at gold and silver, which play such an important role on the palette. And we'll show objects with our paintings and new and very exciting connections. Not just minerals, of course. We've also got ancient figurines made of precious stones, ceramics, textiles. The whole history of Western painting is about interaction with other art forms, and I think this exhibition will express that very beautifully.
With thanks to Caroline Campbell and the Scientific Department, the Making Colour exhibition is now open and will run through to the 7th of September. You can learn more and book tickets by visiting www.nationalgallery.org.uk. And now, every few years, the National Gallery invites a leading contemporary artist to spend time with a collection. The Rootstein Hopkins Associate Artist is given a studio in the building in which to make new work inspired by the old master tradition. Previous incumbents have included Paul Arago, Peter Blake, and most recently Michael Landy. But now, former Turner Prize nominee George Shaw has taken up residence. Council estates and lock-ups, graffiti chop fronts and swings, Shaw is best known for deserted landscapes of suburban Britain that are both beautiful and menacing. It's this duality, perhaps, that the artist was referring to when he said, "Politeness is how I let myself in. My paintings are Trojan horses. Once they're in the house, they can do quite nasty things to you." Special project curator Colin Wiggins met up with Shaw to hear which parts of the collection have piqued his interest since arriving.
The first pictures you seem to have been interested in here are the green ones,
the pictures that are the kind of fantasy landscapes with trees and rivers and, more importantly, nymphs?
Well, yeah, the thing which I was quite drawn to, although I would consider it to be the high culture of the National Gallery, I was actually drawn to the fact that quite a lot of the paintings consisted of scenes which were quite low culture. And it all seems to be happening on the outskirts of a town. That reminds me quite a lot of the subject matter of some of the paintings which I've been working on before I came here, which is of an area of woodland just beyond the estate at which I was brought up, where things happened in the woods that didn't normally happen in the streets. That's where you would drink, smoke. It's where kids would have their first attempts at sex. It would be where you would find and distribute pornographic magazines. I'm beginning to suspect that I'm the naughty nymph in the woods of the National Gallery, exposing certain things which perhaps my art teachers would have liked to have left hidden.
Now, George, the National Gallery was already quite familiar to you, wasn't it? It's not as if we've transplanted you from your council estate in the Midlands to this temple of high art unprepared, because you have been a frequent, if not regular, visitor in the past.
Yeah, visiting the National Gallery was something we would have done as a family. Would have come down to London with Mum and Dad on the coach. And then as I got older, it would have been the kind of place that I would have come to as a teenager, I suppose. Most people my age were wasting their lives revving cars and drinking cider. And I wasted my youth hanging around the National Gallery.
And George, your favourite medium is enamel paints, which always surprises people that you're using a form of paint that isn't usually thought of as an artistic medium. When did you start using enamel paints? Because these are the things that kids use to paint their model Spitfires with, aren't they?
Again, I think it's like we were saying earlier about that sort of naughtiness. It seemed, you know, when I was at the Royal College of Art doing a painting, you know, MA, it seemed very serious, and you're supposed to have, you know, fancy oil paints and have them ground and everything, and it just seemed to be sort of fairly ridiculous and pompous. So to choose something which was, that's the medium of men in sheds, to then to try and make paintings using this sort of the genre subjects of landscape and the nude and these kind of things, using this type of paint, it was quite a, I guess, slightly naughty, slightly mischievous, but slightly perverse as well, because it's quite an annoying thing to use. It's quite an annoying paint. It doesn't want to be a tree, that paint. It doesn't want to be, and as I'm finding out, it doesn't want to be a leg. So, it started off as a sort of little bit of a joke, really. It's been interpreted as being a conceptual move, which, like a lot of conceptualizing in art, it happens certainly within my art, it happens after the event.
So do you think you ever would go back to using pompous oil paint?
Only to paint Airfix figures.
Thanks to Colin Wiggins and George Shaw. The gallery's exhibition, Building the Picture, Architecture in Italian Renaissance Painting, features one of the greatest pictures from Renaissance Venice, now in Britain. Sebastiano del Piombo's The Judgment of Solomon is a treasure from the National Trust's collection. It's an intriguing, unfinished work in which Sebastiano sets the Old Testament king, Solomon, high on a marble throne within an ancient basilica, or judgment hall, surrounded by figures seeking justice in a tragic dispute. Leah Caribbean met exhibition co-curator Amanda Lilly to find out more.
Wow, Amanda, this is such a wonderfully huge, brightly coloured picture, and it's almost like a fresco in feel. Take us through the story.
The story is about two prostitutes or harlots who had two babies at roughly the same time. One of the babies died, and the mother of the dead baby tried to appropriate the baby of the other mother. They took this quarrel to Solomon, and Solomon suggested cutting in half the live baby so that they could have half each. Well, the good mother immediately protested and said she would give up her own baby to the other mother rather than have the baby cut in half. And at this moment, of course, the true mother was revealed to Solomon. The bad mother's on the left and the good mother is on the right.
And yet there are no babies visible in this picture, are there?
The babies were never actually painted in. However, in the underdrawing, technical analysis and x-rays do show the dead baby was, in fact, probably going to be positioned on the steps of Solomon's throne, whereas the live baby is about to be executed or cut in half by the executioner on the right.
So that's the extraordinary figure with his arm raised. That's the executioner. Now, the whole argument of your exhibition, really, as well as the argument for this picture, is that the architecture is actually key to the meaning of the work. How does that work out here in the Sebastiano?
Because it's a tripartite composition designed around a basilica with a central nave and an aisle either side. So it really structures this choice. Solomon, the judge in the centre, and one of the mothers on either side. And the side representing the bad mother and the architecture behind the bad mother is in fact very compressed and squashed and almost anxious, really. You can see the figures here are all crushing in on each other. Whereas the side representing the good mother opens out in an airy, spacious way, and the architecture also opens right out into a full representation of a beautiful aisle on the right. That's what's exciting about this picture, is the horizontal spread of the architecture, creating these wonderful aisles that diminish into space, but also spread out horizontally to literally embrace the viewer.
Amanda Lilly talking about Sebastiano del Piombo's Judgment of Solomon. You can find out more about this and other works in the exhibition in the online publication. Visit www.nationalgallery.org.uk and follow the links for building the picture. The exhibition itself is free of charge and runs in the Sunley Room until the 21st of September. And don't forget, we also have a lively programme of family events this summer. If you're visiting, we're open 10 till 6 daily and till 9 on Fridays. That's it for this episode. Until next time, goodbye.